in the public and the public engagement of the church, : Christ's two kingdoms. And there's a kind of a background to this book, as well as some of the items that are in the book that I'd like to discuss this morning. And I think it's a sort of enlightening. Every decade, it seems, or every 15 years or so, there seems to be in the Reformed flow or pool kind of a volcanic eruption of some sort. You know, we've had the Federal Vision and we've had Reconstructionism. These days we have the two kingdom theology, which is sort of on the other end of the spectrum of all of that. Two kingdoms. The phrase was introduced initially by Luther, and it was meant to indicate a twofold government, as Calvin also understood it and worked hard to theologically differentiate, albeit along different lines and in different ways from Luther. Unlike today, a kingdom in the Reformers' time easily translated into organized political or civic authority as distinct from the church. And we need to understand that. So when we say two kingdoms, two kingdom theology, we say the kingdom of God. Well, wait a minute, you're saying that there's another co-equal kingdom. Well, no, Calvin and the Reformers spoke in terms of kingdoms as being areas of rule and understood the civil government as its own kingdom. There's been a considerable amount of controversy about two kingdoms in certain Reformed circles, notably affecting, I would say, the faithful Dutch churches and the OPC, although not only these. On the one hand, Westminster West in California has become the center of what's called two-kingdom theology. And there are lots of nuances, but in the main, theologians there have made a point of deeply distinguishing the church from all other loci of influence and power, whether governmental, cultural, or sociological. And the sociological today, in sort of postmodern times, can be pretty powerful. It's a reaction likely to Reconstructionism of the 80s and 90s. You know, this is, after all, California we're talking about. But also to the way Dutch Calvinists of a more liberal bent in recent decades have taken Kuyper and leveraged his theology to justify left-leaning causes. So I think to some extent the two-kingdom theology is somewhat of a reaction to that, wanting to remain faithful. So this emphasis on gospel only, which emphasizes Old Testament discontinuity, also has other effects, such as seeing little value in the law, except as being a schoolmaster leading us to Christ, aka Luther, or seeing Old Testament Israel as under a covenant of works, so named, which assures their failure, or most explicitly encouraging the divorce of the church from any involvement in cultural pursuits, whether artistic, political, sociological, etc., seeing this as a waste of time. It's also marked by what I would call an ahistoricism, an understanding that the New Testament background, the New Testament background in the first century, the contemporary history back then on the ground, exactly mirrors our own public concerns today, which is a kind of fundamentalist reading of the New Testament. Now, Matthew Tuninga, who wrote this book, studied at Westminster West in Escondido, but comes from a neo-Calvinist tradition that the seminary has criticized, Kuyperianism, which is culturally conscious while not losing the gospel as its center focus. The Reformed, primarily, I would say, in Canada, where Tuninga is originally from, have long held to this emphasis, chewing gum and walking at the same time, not falling into leftist or, you know, United Nations, Peace Corps interpretations of Christian social involvement, but not giving up on Christian social involvement either. The result has been, among other things, a very strong dedication to Christian education, a self-conscious understanding of the need to develop and maintain a Christian world and life view, and a clarity about the effects of the faith extending beyond one's personal piety, while understanding personal obedience to Christ as, of course, very important. So, on the one hand, there are the liberal Dutch churches that have gone all in on things like social justice, using Kuyper as a lever. And on the other hand, Westminster Escondido, which has said, delete all of the above except for the solas of the gospel. In the middle are many in the URC, United Reformed Churches. The history there is that they had separated from the Christian Reformed Church in the 90s, you know, like the PCA from the larger Presbyterian Church in the 70s, the OPC in the 30s, that kind of thing. So in the middle are many in the URC, the Canadian Reformed Churches, and also the OPC and PCA, though that's a mixed medley. Tuninga, who studied under Van Drunen in Escondido, but has a Kuyperian heritage, has dedicated his doctoral thesis to finding out where Calvin stood in regard to all of this, which is an interesting assignment. In his book, Tuninga uses the phrase two kingdoms, but as Calvin used it, one the church, or the kingdom of God, as with its locus in the church, and then expanding out of that, and then the other, the civil kingdom. Calvin, of course, is credited as having theologically differentiated between the two, and as such, we've long inherited the fruit of Calvin's work, and so may not appreciate the degree to which he argued for this distinction, when during the Reformers' time, the Roman Church and even other Reformers, particularly the Swiss, Zwingli, but then after him, Bullinger, in one sense or another, conflated the two, okay? A civil kingdom and the kingdom of God, or the church. Tuninga shows that a key locus for Calvin was church discipline, which until he took it up, was subsumed in Reformed city-states by the magistrates who investigated and punished crime. And Calvin argued that although this is correct and legitimate, that church discipline has its own right since it's an extension of the ministry of the word. And you have to think in terms of, you know, there are burghers and, you know, people with money and influence in these city-states, and, you know, they go off the rail. Well, should the church then have nothing to say at all about them because of who they are? And in that city state, and to what degree they're funding the church and things of that nature. So Calvin, you know, was objective about this, and he separated, worked very hard theologically to separate church and state for the reason of church discipline. In other words, the church has the keys when it comes to those kind of issues. So this initiated the church, the separation between church and state that has since become the legacy of the West to both good and bad effect. But Tuninga is not interested in the history of this separation's trajectory, which countless books have been dedicated to, right? The result or historical implications and where Calvinism has led in history. He's not interested in that. What he's interested in is this, its theological development in Calvin's work itself. He shows that the Reformer was equally interested in keeping the two institutions differentiated, and particularly in his later theology, ensuring that the civil institution was closely related to the church's teaching, deriving its identity and sphere of responsibility from church doctrine, particularly Calvin's formulation of it, even though it was not, strictly speaking, a revelatory institution. And this is why Calvin could write, you know, to the kings of Europe and the barons and the aristocrats in England, to Edward, advising but also admonishing them to uphold public righteousness, in some cases even calling for punishments against adultery, drunkenness, and blasphemy, to maintain the civil order of a commonwealth in which the Christian religion was adopted. So we need to be careful. We say, well, you know, the separation between church and state originated in Calvin, and people will play that card until, you know, there are no cards left. But Calvin didn't have that interpretation. He believed in the separation, but he didn't have our current contemporary modern interpretation of what that means. Tuninga also shows how Calvin later developed his covenant theology and how he worked out what civil rulers can and should pursue and what they should not, based on how Christian kingdoms were like but also unlike Old Testament Israel. And what spurred him with this historically, you may know, was Anabaptist teaching that dismissed the civil government in its view of a realized eschaton. You know, we don't really need them anymore, you know, because we have Christ. And in this sense, Calvin embraced both continuity and discontinuity, saying in effect that although the magistrates can and should imitate Israel's righteous kings in not only protecting the church, but ensuring orthodox doctrine and piety, that they were not conjoined or identified with the church in that practice. See, that's the distinction. But back then, they called upon the state to protect the church, to even fund the church, and to also follow through on God's law in the society. Neither were they to direct, that is, neither was the civil government to directly copy the Mosaic civil law in its exhaustive specificity in regard to issuing judgments and punishing crime. That was Calvin. However, Calvin developed the notion of general equity in applying Israel's civil laws to crime and their judgments, which was later adopted in the Westminster Standards. But he was selective, and he did apply specific equity for heresy and blasphemy, capital punishment, which he not only argued for, but encouraged magistrates to implement if they hoped to serve in their positions faithfully as Christian princes. Also, he did not understand the New Testament as abrogating, doing away with, capital punishment for adultery or apostate rebellious children, and exegetically defended his position. So there's general equity, and he developed the theological, he formulated that theologically and scripturally defended it. But he also had a notion and understanding of specific equity. So was he then inconsistent? Well, Tenenga shows that Calvin appealed to a crime's severity in such cases rather than in a lockstep adaptation of Old Testament civil law. The Reformer also argued for these applications only as a Christian commonwealth develops consensus to receive them. And that's not inconsistent with what I know of and have seen even documentaries of, of Reconstructionist interviews, Rush Dooney and others in the 80s and 90s. I'm not trying to force this on anybody. Likewise, Tenenga examines Calvin's theology of lesser magistrates, their right and their ability to supervene higher magistrates' unfaithful and wicked actions, especially, but not only, in regard to church matters and persecution of Orthodox believers. The development of this doctrine has had vast implications for us, for Western society, justifying back then, or a century later, the 30 Years' War, but also in the English-speaking world, the English Civil War, the U.S.'s War for Independence, its development of the political doctrine of states' rights, and the war between the states. Originally a doctrinal thesis, the book is exhaustive in its interplay with both Calvin's works and Calvin's scholarship in what is clearly an honest and thorough attempt to get to the bottom of the Reformer's thinking on how church and state are to interact. It's as though Tenenga hearing one thing in Escondido and another from his heritage, is going to Calvin to see what the Reformer really thought. Alas, there are complexities in Calvin, seeming inconsistencies and differing emphases in regard to his theological formulations. Though, as Tenenga shows, the separation of powers remains constant. As examples, the law in Calvin is not only threefold, moral, civil, ceremonial, but variously interrelational in post-Pentecost times, based on numerous continuities and discontinuities between the Old and New Testaments. Also, Calvin openly called upon magistrates to enforce biblical law to ensure their societies remain blessed, while in other contexts, he wrote rather extensively about how there was no direct connection between Christian obedience and blessing on earth, as seen in the lives of martyrs. Further, while Calvin exegetically worked to show the civil magistracy is not a spiritual institution at all, in his later writing, he seems to call upon magistrates to act out of spiritual conviction and motivation. In terms of the Great Commission, there's also his stated non-commitment. I can even use the word, I will use the word agnosticism, to the inevitable advance of the faith and however interrupted progress. Yet he writes of its goal as being, quote, the world from one end to the other. Presumably, were the faith to permeate that far, wouldn't the civil authorities in those nations likewise become wise so as to be moved to kiss the sun, ensuring as much as it's up to them that they protect the church and promote it in terms of its orthodoxy and piety, as European Christendom should also do, and also punish wicked crimes that introduce chaos and unrest in these nations' social orders. So, The point here is that not everything is neat in Calvin, if considered in toto. And that's what Tuninga does. He doesn't look only at the institutes, but all of the commentaries, all of the correspondence, the catechisms and confessions, and all of his works. Calvin, of course, and happily missed the Enlightenment, and so the need to develop a black box, thoroughly consistent theology, which would open it to being discarded as soon as an exception were found, was not his way of doing things, was not his modus operandi, except perhaps in writing confessions and catechisms. He also, like theologians before him, flexibly appealed to natural law, even seeing the Ten Commandments as a summary of it, which aided his development of a theology of civil authority without having to cast it into the spiritual realm, left only to the church. So this he did even while insisting, we need to be reminded of this also, he did this even while insisting that the civil authority be scripturally informed and act accordingly. And he was also an opportunist, in a good sense, revving up his theology of civil authority when the times warranted, whether in answering Anabaptist enthusiasts or speaking specifically to kingdoms, especially those that had openly embraced the Reformed faith. So it is clear that Calvin saw the need to preserve and justify the powers of civil government against Anabaptist enthusiasms, while also limiting its scope when it came to the province of the church. And yet not so much so as to have the two institutions develop polity and act on it completely independently of one another, as though behind closed doors, only for one to find out what the other has done once the polity goes into effect. And this is a difference between Calvin and two kingdom theology. The civil authority was to ensure the church was properly funded and that orthodox doctrine and piety held sway in its civil kingdom, even if coercively by the sword, and yet was not to be deemed a spiritual institution in its own right. The church, on the other hand, was to scripturally educate the civil authority, which was understood by Calvin then to be a temporary natural law, but also in some sense revelatorily informed institution, though not an eternal, spiritually reformed one like the church. In the end, there's really nothing.